Right. All right. This morning we are launching into a new little series. It kind of continues what we've been working through all year, where we look at different parts of Scripture, but we're looking at a specific collection of Old Testament books that are often called wisdom literature. Wisdom literature is the books of Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Job. When we get to Job, we're going to look at that next week. It's very important to understand that it's wisdom literature, to understand what it's talking about and what it's trying to say. And the other one is Song of Songs. Some people don't include Song of Songs as wisdom literature. I do, partly because I didn't want to have to come up with a graphic for the front of the bulletin just for Song of Songs. But it really does. It's because what wisdom literature is trying to do is there's a couple of things. But the first is it invites people to ask big questions. Like big, significant, meaningful questions of life for individuals. A second thing that it invites people to do, if we can go to the next slide there, Micah, it speaks to the deeper questions of life. It doesn't just invite us to ask them, but actually speaks into those deeper questions. But ultimately, what wisdom literature is trying to do is it's trying to provide wise counsel for how to live a good life. It's not rules. It's very important to know. Wisdom literature is not rules. If you start reading wisdom literature as rules that you must follow, then you're going to start to miss out. It's not universal absolute truths. It's not like, if this happens, this will always happen. If you start reading wisdom literature as though it's a universal absolute truth, you will run into problems, especially when you read Proverbs. For example, I know many parents who have spent decades wrought with guilt because they read the proverb, train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it, as a universal absolute truth, and because their kids were struggling, therefore, if that is true universally 100% of the time, it was their fault because they failed as parents. It is not meant to be a universal absolute truth. We'll get to Proverbs in a... Well, we're going to spend most of the summer in Proverbs, actually. It's wise counsel for how to live a good life. It is basically, it's general good life advice. You want some good life advice? Look at the wisdom literature in the Bible. Wisdom literature is very interesting compared to almost the entire rest of Scripture. Because wisdom literature is written to help individuals learn how to live well personally. Most of Scripture is written to the community. It's written to the people of God. And there's individual application as a result of that, but most of it is written to communities, Old and New Testament. It's written to communities of people. And we actually get into some very dangerous areas when we start reading stuff that's written to community and think it's written just to me. The flip side would be true. If we read this stuff that's designed to help individuals understand, you know, deeply personal ways of living and start thinking it's just for the community, we can start thinking, well, it's for everybody else, but not for me. But wisdom literature is written to be deeply personal, not written just to the community. It is communal in context, but it's like, how do I live well? Wisdom literature helps to communicate that. So our plan over the next few weeks is, today I'm talking about the book of Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes is the book, I think Ecclesiastes is one of the most honest books in the Bible. But definitely within the wisdom literature. Next week we're going to talk about Job. And I think Job calls on each of us to wrestle with some really important, deep questions. The week after that, we're just going to party together, have a community picnic. The week after that, Glenn is going to be speaking on Song of Songs. He volunteered, and I did not argue. And then the week after that, I'm going to be introducing Proverbs. And actually, through the summer, we're going to be looking at collections of Proverbs, just wise life advice for how to live. for most of the summer. That is what we are doing, with some exceptions and some breaks in there. So Ecclesiastes. It actually starts with an introduction and a conclusion, just one verse at the beginning and a handful of verses at the end by kind of the narrator. And then most of the book unpacks the teachings of this one that is called the teacher. Here's how the teachings of the teacher start. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. What does anyone gain from all their labors, at which they toil under the sun? Generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. The wind blows to the south and turns to the north. Round and round it goes, ever returning on its course. All streams flow to the sea, yet the sea is never full. To the place where the streams come from, there they return again. All things are wearisome, more than one can say. The eye never has enough of seeing, nor the ear its fill of hearing. What has been will be done again. What has been done will be done again. There's nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which one can say, look, there's something new? It was here already, long ago. It was here before our time. There's no remembrance of people of old, and even those who are yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow them. Anybody happy yet? Oh, man. Ecclesiastes. I said it was one of the most honest books, because how many people have had a day where you felt that? Oh, what am I doing here? Nothing new. Nobody remembers. Days come and days go. And what was it for? There's really two great themes in the book of Ecclesiastes. The first is this theme. The NIV translates it meaningless, meaningless. Everything is meaningless. That word itself actually describes smoke or a vapor. What happens when you blow out a candle that's been lit for a while? You know that puff that kind of comes when you blow it out? How long does that usually last? Too long for some of us? It doesn't usually take very long before it kind of disappears and it's gone. The smell remains, but what was there is gone. The idea behind this word is that life is a vapor or smoke, or fog, something that you can see, and it actually, like, you can draw it, right? Like, you can see that it has shape, but if you try and, like, capture that shape, what happens if you try and grab smoke or fog? It's gone. You can't contain it, you can't hold on to it, and it disappears quickly. That's this word that says meaningless here. It's just, that's what life is like. That's the first theme, and this carries out throughout the book, that life is this vapor, this smoke. And there's two parts of that. The first of that is fleeting. It's temporary. It's not something permanent. Here at the beginning of the book, it's all about the passage of time. Generations come, generations go. The sun rises, the sun sets. Time is always moving. Time is always passing. And no matter how much we might try and stop time, it's impossible to do. Anybody realize that yet? No matter what, it's always going to be, today will always become tomorrow. Yesterday. It will always become yesterday. It was tomorrow yesterday. Tomorrow it will be yesterday. Time always moves. At the end of the book, you get to the end of the last chapter, he comes back to the theme of just the non-permanency of life, but it talks about the imminence of death. And we don't need to read it or spend a lot of time focusing on that, but he gets to the end and it's like, eventually, we're going to pass away. People go to their eternal home and mourners go about the streets. Remember him before the silver cord is severed. That image of death. Before the golden bowl is broken, before the pitcher is shattered at the spring and the wheel broken at the well, and the dust returns to the ground it came from, and the spirit returns to the God who gave it. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Everything is meaningless. That's chapter 12. Time always moves. Death always comes. Everything is meaningless. That's the first theme. Sounds really exciting for something we find in wisdom literature. The other piece to that life is a vapor is not just that it's fleeting and temporary, but it's something that can't be controlled or grasped, no matter how hard we try. If I asked you on a foggy morning to go down to the bay and grab some fog and bring it to my house, it would be a challenge to do that. Because you can't grab at fog or smoke. You can't hold on to it. And the writer of Ecclesiastes, the teacher in Ecclesiastes, he goes through chapter after chapter of all the stuff he tries to hold on to control life, to make sure it's got this sense of purpose and structure and clarity. In chapter 2, he launches into these things. Verse 1 to 3, he says, "Come now, I will test you with pleasure to find out what is good." He thinks, if I can just pursue all of the pleasure of life, if I can just, you know, have the most fun, have the most toys, then everything will be great. Anybody know anybody who lives their life like this? And yet you get to verse 2. Oh no, the end of verse 1 of chapter 2. He says, "But that also proved to be meaningless. Laughter, I said, is meaningless. And what does pleasure accomplish? I tried cheering myself with wine and embracing folly, my mind still guiding me with wisdom. I wanted to see what was good for people to do under heavens during the first days of their lives. But it was all meaningless, chasing after pleasure." So as he continues to explore, unfold his life and the stuff he tried in Ecclesiastes 2, he says, "I undertook great projects. I built houses, planted vineyards, made gardens, parks, planted fruit trees, made reservoirs to water groves of flourishing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had other slaves who were born in my house. I owned herds and flocks more than anyone in Jerusalem. I amassed silver and gold." This is all about wealth. All the land he's getting, all of the property he's getting, all the slaves he's getting. "I got silver and gold. I got male and female singers and a harem, all the delights of a man's heart. I became greater by far than anyone in Jerusalem before me. And then all of this wisdom stayed with me." He says he denied himself nothing his eyes desired. He refused his heart no pleasure. His heart took delight in all the labor, and this was a reward for all his toil. Yet when he surveyed all that his hands had done, all that he toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless, chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun. He tried through pleasure. He tried through wealth. The next set of verses, he tried through wisdom. "Then I turned my thoughts to consider wisdom, and also madness and folly. What more can a king's successor do than what has already been done? I saw that wisdom is better than folly, just as light is better than darkness. The wise have eyes in their heads, while fools walk in darkness. But I came to realize that the same fate overtakes them both. I said to myself, the fate of the fool will overtake me also. What then do I gain by being wise? I said to myself, this too is meaningless." Even getting all the wisdom in the world, all of the best ways of understanding and knowing, proved to be meaningless. 17 to 23, I won't read it all. "He hated life because the work that had been done under the sun was grievous to me. All of it is meaningless." He talks about all of the toil he did, all of the work he did, all of the effort. You know, I can define myself by the work that I do, by the labor that I put into things. But even that is meaningless. Chasing after the wind. So that's the first big theme, is that life is a vapor. Life is smoke. It's fleeting and temporary, and that we can't control it or box it or harness it no matter how hard we try. There's nothing new under the sun. Everything that has been done will be done again. And so no matter what we put into it, it's not going to be contained. I heard something on a podcast the other day that reminded me of just how fleeting things are and how even the greatest things we think we do can come to nothing. Anybody here enjoy math? Some do. So I do not. My father does. But I heard on this podcast, it was talking about this idea that there really isn't anything new. And it was talking about calculus, which the early stages of calculus were invented in like the 1400s, I think, and then it got developed as it went on. They have found some ancient Mesopotamian, like so Babylonian era, a cuneiform. I don't know, Babylonians used to track the movement of the moon and the stars and the sun. They used to track it very, very closely. And in order to do some math to figure the calculations, they actually had like the base level of calculus invented like 1,400 years before Christ and recorded in cuneiform writings, that it took people who could read cuneiform and understand enough math to realize what they were talking about. But it was 1,400 years before Jesus, like 2,800 years before calculus was supposedly invented. They already had the foundations of calculus created and recorded, and they were working with it to help calculate the movement of planetary systems. And yet it got completely lost until like thousands of years later. And all these people are going like, hey, we found something new, only to realize that these ancient peoples had done it many years before. And that was just recently, it was just a couple of years ago, it was discovered in these cuneiform writings that what they've had for centuries thought was new was not actually new at all. That's the first thing. Life is a vapor. It's smoke. It's fleeting. It's temporary. We can't control it and harness it no matter how hard we try. That is the depressing side of Ecclesiastes. And he keeps going back to that. But in the middle of all of that, there's a second theme that's rehearsed. We read this in chapter 2, verse... I'm just going to read... Because it says it over and over and over again, in the midst of the meaninglessness of everything else. Chapter 2, verse 24 and 25, he says, you know, a person can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in their own toil. This, I see, is from the hand of God. For without him, who can eat or find enjoyment? Chapter 3, verse 12 and 13. I know there is nothing better for people than to be happy and do good while they live, that each of them may eat and drink and find satisfaction in all their toil. This is the gift of God. In the midst of all this meaninglessness, the second theme is that life is a gift to enjoy, not to control. It's a vapor. You can't control it. You can't harness it. You can't, no matter what you do, it's going to disappear. So the invitation is to just enjoy this gift. Not try and control it or manipulate it or box it or think of like what's going to be here 1,000 years from now. No, just enjoy the moments you have. Chapter 5, verse 18 and 19. This is what I have observed to be good, that it is appropriate for a person to eat, to drink, to find satisfaction in their toilsome labor under the sun during the few days of life God has given them. For this is their lot. Moreover, when God gives someone wealth and possessions and the ability to enjoy them, to accept their lot and be happy in their toil. This is a gift from God. Chapter 8, verse 15. So I commend the enjoyment of life, because there's nothing better for a person under the sun than to eat and drink and be glad. Then joy will accompany them in their toil. All their days of their life God has given them under the sun. Chapter 9, 7 to 10. Go, eat your food with gladness, and drink your wine with a joyful heart. For God has already approved of what you do. Always be clothed in white and always anoint your head with oil. That's contrast to being someone who's moping and grieving all the time, lamenting. Be happy. Enjoy life with your wife whom you love all the days of this meaningless life that God has given you under the sun. All your meaningless days. For this is your lot in life and in your toilsome labor under the sun. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. For in the realm of the dead, where you're going, there's neither working nor planning nor knowledge nor wisdom. The journey of the teacher is a journey between these two opposite poles. This pull between, what am I doing this for? But I have these moments of joy and happiness and gladness with a good meal and my family and this chance to laugh together. And do I have to find this bigger reason for every single thing I do? I can just enjoy this moment. It's this life is this journey between two opposite poles. I think most of us can relate to this pole between these tensions. You know, this idea that nothing we do ultimately will last, but we're supposed to still work hard and live life to the full. That there's nothing that's new. But as Ecclesiastes says in chapter 3, there's a time for everything. Nothing we gain, wealth, success, wisdom truly lasts. But in this book, he also talks about, but pursue wisdom, because it's still better to see than to be walking around in darkness. What are some things, I'm just curious, we have time for a bit of conversation. What are some things that you feel the pull between in your life? The tension between this and this. Yeah?
A to-do list.
Yeah? Explain that, because we all have lists of what we got to do.
I find I got to write things down that I need to get at, and it relieves them of the carnal thoughts of forgetting something. You know, it could be replace the garden hose. I mean, just stuff, right? But you got to be careful that you don't just embrace your to-do list if that's who you are.
And yeah. Yeah.
Is, you got to be careful. Right? We've all got stuff to do, but in the end of the day, you know, as Ecclesiastes is saying, where's the quality? Where's the? I think where's evil can evil. I heard him on the Hour of Power. He had a plane with a name on the side, and he bought a second plane to sit in that plane and look at his first plane and see his name, and then he realized his life was dead. He had nothing except God. And, you know, I mean, I think lots of people eventually hit the spot when you realize you're not your to-do list.
Yeah. The yeah. You're a human being, not doing. Yeah. Anybody else? Things that you find tension between? Mary. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, pulled between what we want to do and what we can do is a pull. Yeah. Anybody else? Do you find it a comfort or a frustration that this thing that was written 3,000 years ago, they experienced the same stuff. Right? Sometimes we think that because technology, because things are changing so much faster, that, well, nobody's been through this before. And yet we read stuff like this and we're like, actually, everybody's been through this before. Anna Karenina, the Leo Tolstoy novel. It deals with all kinds of different classes in the Russian system. It's got military people, it's got clergy, it's got the wealthy elite, and all these people are striving and trying to figure out their purpose and meaning. And the whole book is actually about Anna Karenina's quest to try and find purpose. She married a guy for money, and she had all the wealth in the world, but she wasn't happy. So she left him and lived with a young military officer for love and pleasure, and found nothing in that. And her whole life is found chasing it, and it drove her crazy because the only people she found were happy were the peasants who weren't working towards anything other than, what are we going to do to get the harvest in today? And once we've done the work for today, we're going to celebrate with family, and then we're going to wake up tomorrow and we'll do the work we have to do tomorrow. They weren't gaining anything. They were never going to get rich. They were going to never get out of their system, but get out of their class. But they were the only people that she found that had any type of joy. But in order to have that joy, she was going to have to give up the quest for significance and wealth and power and pleasure. She wasn't ready to do that. It's been something that has existed for generations, for millennia. Ultimately, the book of Ecclesiastes, as it points out this observation, this tension between what we're trying to grab a hold of, the smoke we're trying to hold on to, and just simply enjoying the pleasures of life, enjoying the moment, rather than trying to box the fog, just stand at the top of the hill and enjoy the view as it crests over the bay. Ultimately, the writer of Ecclesiastes is inviting us to joy, not to lament, not to sit with this refrain of it's meaningless, so what's the point? He says, well, it's meaningless, so accept your limitations. Stop chasing the wind. If you can accept that it's meaningless, why is all of your life going after that? Instead, do the work you have to do today, but recognize that the world is bigger than you and that God is still there and he's carrying things through. And so you can just rest in him. And because you know that he's got it in control, you don't have to control it. I don't have to control it. And when it's out of our grasp, we can still sit and enjoy the beautiful things and wonderful gifts of God, as it refers to all of it in Ecclesiastes. It's an invitation to joy as we accept, I'll say as you accept your limitations, because it's a very personal book. As I accept my limitations, it's an amazing gift of freedom when you let go. Have you guys heard the story of the monkey that would get trapped? In Africa, they were trying to trap monkeys, and so they would hollow out a large nut and put a bit of food in it, and the monkeys would come along. They'd reach in to grab the food, and the monkey would get stuck because it would refuse to let go of the food. If he just let go, he could pull his hand out and be free to live its life well. But its quest for something more would keep it stuck, and so they could come and catch it because it refused to let go. The invitation of Ecclesiastes is to open the hand and let go. Accept your limitations. Second part is that it's an invitation to joy through enjoying the simple pleasures of life. I put this to be present in moments, not be worrying about what's out there all the time, to stop and smell the roses, to actually taste the food that we're eating, to look each other in the eye and listen well to what others have to say, to turn off, I'll say this personally, to turn off my cell phone, to gather, to laugh, to cry, to hug, to just enjoy the life that we have been given. And the last thing, Ecclesiastes ends. It goes through all of this teacher's teaching, and then the narrator steps back in. Not only was the teacher wise, this starts in chapter 12, verse 9, but also he imparted knowledge to the people. He pondered and searched out and set in order many proverbs. The teacher searched to find just the right words, and what he wrote was upright and true. The words of the wise are like goads. They're collected sayings like firmly embedded nails given by one shepherd. A goad is not very comfortable. It's like they're prodding you to go the right direction. It's not nice to hear this sense of meaninglessness to stuff, but if it prompts us in the right direction, it's helpful and good. Of making many books, there is no end, and much study wearies the body. Now all has been heard. Here is the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the duty of every human being. For God will judge every deed, and God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether it is good or evil. The summary at the end is, here's the solution to everything. Just love God and do his commandments. And as Jesus came and made his commandments really clear and summarized for us, it's love God and love people. Live in right relationship with God and with others, and leave the judgment to God. He'll take care of that. Love God and love people well. Live this life of love. Enjoy God's love and take rests in the fact that the one who does know all and is over everything knows you and loves you. And from that place of security, enjoy loving those around you. Those around you whom this teacher describes as gifts from God. Because everything else is just grabbing after the smoke, chasing the winds. I hope today doesn't discourage you, but rather causes you to think about, like, what am I grabbing after? How much of what I'm trying to hold on to is vapor, fog, smoke? And how much in my quest to hold on to those things am I not enjoying the gifts that God has given me in the present? We're going to close by singing a song together, just reminding us of where our hope and rest and security is found. I'm going to invite you to stand with us while we sing as a prayer, "All my hope is in you."